This is Greater LA, the show on KCRW that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis, and today, a trip up the coast. A three-hour drive north and west of Los Angeles is the only stretch of beach in the Golden State that you can drive your car onto. But at Oceano Dunes, off-highway vehicles, or OHVs, are the ones that reign supreme. The wind is really blowing, and the Pacific is in sight as Cesar Meza sits behind the wheel atop one of the countless sandy hills in the Oceano Dunes State Vehicular Recreation Area.
We're out here four-wheeling, enjoying the dunes, having fun, spending time with the friends, family.
People are out cruising the dunes on quads and motorcycles, and yeah, even aptly named dune buggies. But all this off-road action, well, the clock is winding down on it. After almost 40 years of OHV access, the California Coastal Commission recently decided it was taking too much of a toll on the environment. They said four-wheeling will be reduced to no-wheeling in 3 years, and that has a lot of folks, including Meza, bummed.
We're actually pretty sad because it's something that's fun, that we get along with everybody here. It's something that distracts you and gets you out of the normal routine.
But while some folks are mourning, the planned closure has others rejoicing. KCRW's Matt Gillum has a look at the dust-up over the dunes.
Despite the fact you can drive on the beach at Oceano Dunes, I'm not that bold, at least not with my station wagon. So I'm hoofing it down the beach. As I walk along, families have parked trucks and SUVs, some even tempting fate with their cars, on the shore and are having picnics or just goofing around. And then, a mile down, Anthony Chavez is unloading his quad. The 18-year-old is here for a couple days of camping and family time. It's something of a tradition for them, and he's just learned of the plan to end off-roading.
I don't think they should close it down. I think they should keep it open. I've been coming here since I was 8, and it'd be sad to see this place close down. Having a lot of family, good memories here. It's a beautiful to be able to camp, ride off-road vehicles, and be at the ocean. Like, this is just a perfect combination.
Thanks to the park's location along the Central Coast, that perfect combination is super popular with families from the Central Valley. More than a third of people coming to this stretch of coastline are from Bakersfield or Fresno. And camping on the beach? It's just $10 a night. For a lot of Californians, Oceano Dunes is the closest and most affordable place to spend a few days riding and unwinding. All that recreating is translated into business, and I'm going to take shelter from the wind in one. There's a store parked on the beach. Out front, big signs advertise flags and flagpoles and helmets and goggles. And right near the entrance, warning, contents of this trailer are known to be fun and habit-forming. At the back of the shop, behind the register, is Angelica Markison. The 24-year-old from the nearby town of Grover Beach has been working out here for 3 years. She says the recent decision by the Coastal Commission to wind down off-roading at the dunes and limit uses of the beach would be a hit to the entire region.
This is a really small area, so we don't really have as many jobs available in this small five cities town. A lot of people have to drive farther away, but having the dunes open was allowing a lot more people to find jobs out here. But without that, everyone is just kind of, what do we do now?
A very detailed 2017 report commissioned by the State Parks Department found the Oceano Dunes were responsible for an estimated 3,300 jobs and generated millions in economic activity. But let's take a break from the sand for a minute and look at what got the dunes to this critical moment. Off-highway vehicle, or OHV use at the dunes, has never been a guaranteed permanent thing, says Steve Padilla, the chair of the California Coastal Commission.
It was a temporary permit and must be periodically reviewed, and I know it sounds a little crazy to folks when you say temporary and it's been decades.
It was 1982 when the temporary permit was issued. Over those decades, the commission has been in a dance with the State Parks Department about the coastline. The Parks Department has done one study after another looking at how best to preserve the environment while allowing for recreation here, and even after nearly 40 years, never quite reached a conclusion. According to Padilla, the decisive study or review always seemed to be just over the horizon. And so, on March 18th, the question finally came to a head. The Coastal Commission held a marathon Zoom meeting. The public comment period spanned hours. Conservationists and some locals cited concerns about dust, vulnerable species like the snowy plover, and noise issues. Off-roaders and other locals said many recreationists are responsible stewards of the beach, environmental impacts are minimal, and riding the dunes is part of family life.
I've been Googling this all morning for hours, and I do not see this as true at all. Even the American...
Well, after nightfall, the Coastal Commission unanimously voted to end off-highway vehicle use. While Padilla is sympathetic to people who love hitting the dunes in Jeeps, he thinks ending vehicle access is the best plan.
Almost all of this park is designated as environmentally sensitive habitat. The only uses that are permitted there are what we call coastal dependent uses. OHV riding is not coastal dependent. In other words, it doesn't require being on the coast or near the coast in order to exist.
For their part, the California State Parks Department says the environmental impact isn't that bad. Dust output is down by almost 50% over the last decade, but now it's out of their hands. Back on the beach, the winds are whipping and I have yet to get an actual sense of the dunes. I've never ridden a quad in my life, and mercifully, this isn't going to be the day because the pandemic has closed all the rental shops. Fortunately, Kyle Bates has offered to give me a ride in his blue Jeep. It's got a flag flying from the back reading Save Our Dunes. As we roll down the beach, the speed limit is 15 miles per hour, Bates tells me he's a member of the Jerk Pirates. They're not jerks, quite the opposite actually. They're a bunch of volunteers who keep an eye on the dunes and provide a big service.
If people get stuck in a vehicle, you know, coming out on the beach, we go ahead and we tow them out. Because if you hire a tow company to come out here and tow you out, it can be anywhere between $100 to $1,000, depending on how stuck you are.
Bates grew up in the area and has been off-roading here for decades. He's a big backer of the organization Friends of Oceano Dunes. The group supports what they call all forms of responsible recreation and is working on a legal challenge to the Coastal Commission's shutdown plan. Our Jeep has gone a little inland, and we're now in a sea of sand. Bates pulls up to the base of a steep dune.
Whoa!
In a matter of seconds, we're on top of it.
All right. That was really fun.
As we laugh off my first dune ascent, Bates says the dunes and the beach were a formative part of his youth, one he wants to share in the future.
My friends and I would come out here, our girlfriends, you know, family members, everything, would just come out here and have a good time. And I'd like to one day bring my kids out here and have them enjoy riding and seeing everything it has to offer.
It's a big unknown if he'll get to do that. Lawsuits from the group Bates is a part of will contest the ban on off-roading here, and the Coastal Commission and the State Parks Department may find a compromise that still permits some of this activity. For now, OHV use will continue at Oceano Dunes, at least for 3 more years. But with a looming expiration date, each day of off-roading seems to pass like sands through the hourglass. For KCRW, I'm Matt Gilbert.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Well, closer to home along the coast in Long Beach, there is one less lifeguard tower watching the water. It burned down last week, the first time that that's happened in at least 70 years. And this wasn't just any lifeguard tower. Back in June, it had been painted in rainbow colors in honor of gay pride. Well, now, a city once praised by the Human Rights Campaign for its LGBTQ-friendly laws and policies, is grappling with the implications. Long Beach Mayor Robert Garcia is with us now to talk about it. Mr. Mayor, thanks for being here.
Hey, happy to be here. Thank you.
What is the latest with the investigation? Do we know? I mean, obviously it burned down. Do we know what happened and was it by accident? Is this on purpose?
Well, the investigation itself is ongoing, and so we won't know the complete results of that for some time. But I think that what we do know is pretty clear. We have not had a lifeguard station burn down in over 70 years. We've gone all the way back to the 1950s, and the one lifeguard station that has burned down in these last few decades is the one that was painted for pride in rainbow colors in just the last year. And so these things are hard to burn down. And so it's been pretty clear to us what happened. And The community is upset, as am I.
Who is behind the Rainbow Tower? How did it get painted in the first? Give us a little history of how it became painted and the gay pride aspect of it.
Well, the tower itself was actually painted by the lifeguards. And so the lifeguards, LGBTQ plus lifeguards, themselves took the initiative and, to support each other and to support the community, they went out and painted the tower. Last year, it was amazing to see when it was done. It's like a very popular place for the community and for tourists and folks taking pictures. And so it's something that's, for us, a point of pride. I mean, the Long Beach is a very kind of pro-gay, progressive community. We loved it. And they're probably more upset than anybody else about what happened.
What's your personal reaction when you heard about it?
Oh, well, personally, I was both upset and sad. I mean, obviously, as a gay person myself, but also as mayor of the city, it's really unfortunate that someone or some folks would be so hateful and burn something down that way that represents a symbol in the city. But I also, it's a reminder that as forward thinking and inclusive as a community is and the state is, there are still a lot of people that are not supportive of the LGBTQ plus community or about equality.
The story has actually received some national attention as well. Are you concerned that it could negatively affect Long Beach's image as friendly to gay rights, to LGBTQ plus community?
I'm not, because I think that folks know that the city is very forward-thinking. We have one of the largest LGBTQ plus populations in the state. We're constantly ahead of the game when it comes to inclusivity laws and have been for many, many years. In fact, I think what's more important is the reaction the community's had, and I think that's been covered as well. And the community has completely come together and renounced what happened. And we're already replacing the tower. It will be repainted and redone and rebuilt. And like I've said, we're gonna redo it even bigger and better than before. So I think, if anything, I think it shows the strength of the city and our support for diversity and inclusivity.
Are you doing anything differently in terms of community outreach or policing? I mean, do you think in this case this is maybe just a one-off incident, or maybe this could be like a pattern? Are you worried about that?
I mean, our lifeguards and our police are obviously taking some, just additional note and are, kind of looking out a little bit more. But we have not had a history of this type of activity in the city. Again, it has been 70 plus years since that we know of that anything like this has happened to a lifeguard tower. So we're pretty optimistic that this is a kind of a one-off kind of hate incident, but we're still vigilant. And most importantly, I mean, people are themselves more aware and are taking a look. And I think when the new one comes on board, we're absolutely going to pay a little closer attention. And I think the lifeguards are going to as well.
I've got to ask you, you mentioned that you're gay and you're a politician. It can be difficult to win an election as a gay person, although we see in San Diego that the mayor there is gay, openly gay. The governors of Colorado and Oregon are openly gay as well. And I wonder, in your lifetime, you've been mayor there for quite a few years now, have you seen sort of a wholesale change in the political aspect of it? Like, it's not as hard to win an election as a gay person.
Well, it's definitely changed. I mean, I think when I first ran, I definitely had my moments. I mean, you certainly get folks at the door when you're knocking on doors. Some won't answer, and some send you very nasty notes. And I've had my fair share of people yell things at me and not very nice things. And those are some very homophobic comments. But that's actually changed some. And I think that still exists for some. It's just that group is just a lot smaller now. And so I think people are more accepting of candidates of all different backgrounds. And I think you got to run openly and be proud of who you are. And I'm just thankful that Long Beach has given me the chance to lead the city and did so when I got reelected. So I think it's easier than ever to get elected as a gay person, as an openly gay person. But we got to still continue to do the work.
I would be remiss, Mr. Mayor, if I didn't mention how difficult a year that it's been for you and your family. Both your mom and your stepfather died from COVID-19 this past year. And number one, I'm so sorry for your loss. How are you holding up?
Well, thank you. Doing okay. I think, obviously, losing a parent, and let alone two parents, is very hard, and it's difficult for anybody, and it certainly has been for my family and I. But I also, you know, learned an enormous amount from them, and they have certainly their advice, and certainly my mom's kind of worldview, having been a healthcare worker herself and an essential worker, has absolutely informed our response and has absolutely made me a better leader and has helped us, I think, respond in Long Beach in a way that all of us are proud of. So, her legacy and their work just continues on in the work we do here in the city.
Yeah, again, I'm so sorry about that. And I know you guys have your own public health department, right? Separate from L.A. County.
Yeah, we have our own health department here in Long Beach, separate of L.A. County. I always share with folks, I don't think people realize how big Long Beach is, right? We're roughly the same size as Atlanta, Georgia. It's a big city.
Do you think running your own show over there has helped or maybe has hurt?
100% helped. No question about it.
What about the county, being a part of the county, has hindered or would have hindered you?
Well, first of all, I have a lot of, admiration for the folks of the county, and I think they have a huge job. But controlling our own destiny here has been beneficial for us. I mean, you look at, for example, the percentage of folks that are vaccinated. Over one-third of all eligible adults are vaccinated in Long Beach, and our numbers outpace the rest of the county. And so we've been able to just move faster, and that's because we've been able to make decisions quicker and, I think, solve problems faster as well.
Long Beach Mayor Robert Garcia. Mr. Mayor, thanks for your time today. We do appreciate it.
Sure thing. Thanks.
It's Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. In just a couple of weeks, the youngest students at LA Unified Schools will be back in physical classrooms after a year of virtual learning. These kids have had to adapt to a pandemic that's forced friendships online, introduced the words virus and Zoom into their lexicon, and has them trying to process a slew of emotions. So with all that in mind, we wanted to capture the moment by inviting parents to interview their own children about this past year, to find out what they've missed, or maybe what they've learned, and how they're feeling about the future. And here are some of those conversations.
Graham.
Yeah?
Four questions. The first question is, the pandemic has been going on for a year. When you look back at it, how do you feel about it?
I don't really know what a pandemic is.
The virus.
Well, before the virus is here, I liked it being that way, but now that the virus is here, I am very, very mad.
It's been tough staying home and being cramped inside all the time. I have been getting out on a few bike rides, but it doesn't feel like it used to be. There's a lot less play dates, and I've only had one sleepover over the entire pandemic.
Make you happy, sad?
Happy and sad.
You want to go near people, and you can't right now?
Uh-huh.
Oh.
Everything's been shut down, and I haven't been able to do anything. And this is my last year in middle school, so I would have been doing a lot of fun stuff, but I've been so bored and been doing nothing, and there is probably no positives. The only positive would be being able to spend time with my family, but I don't even know if that's a positive.
Are there things with friends or school or life that you feel like you missed out on? If so, what are they?
I missed out on school a lot. I'm pretty sure I'm behind because of Zoom, and it's not teaching us anything, and it's also bad for your health and your eyes.
And there was this fifth grade science camp that I was supposed to go to, but since COVID happened, it was canceled, but I was really interested in it.
This was the year where Bat Mitzvah was supposed to happen, and I've been to like two because of COVID, and I haven't been able to go to the mall with my friends. I haven't seen half of my friends in like a year, so I don't even know if I have that many friends anymore.
Well, I did feel like I've missed out a lot on math because I'm not very good in math. It's especially hard on online school. Zoom makes it very difficult.
I just can't take it anymore. It's just really, I can't do math. So I'm gonna have to like relax at that time.
Have you learned anything, or is there something new you've learned during this year?
Well, we have learned about personal space.
Hmm, that's a good thing to learn about.
Well, yeah. But if the virus gets me, he popped my bubble.
That is true.
Well, I don't know if the virus is a he or she.
Me neither. I don't think it's either.
I think it's a he.
Think so? Okay.
So schools may return in-person learning in the next few months. How are you feeling about that?
I feel excited and I can't wait to get back.
Excited to see some friends and hopefully meet my teacher face to face.
I'm a little excited for that I can play with friends.
It's gonna make me a little bit nervous because like it's like gonna be the first day and we're not gonna be really used to it.
I'm a little nervous and excited at the same time, but nervous is about what if the teachers all get it? What if we all get it? And the excited is I get to go back to in person because I get to play recess, but it's not gonna be the same. It's gonna be hybrid learning.
Really, because I like being home, but on the calls, I feel like they're kind of boring in my opinion. So it probably might be better to go to school, so then the like classes won't be boring, because I think it'd be cool to see my teacher in person. So, and we're just gonna be there for 3 hours, so it's gonna be fine.
I used to dread school and all the work that came with it. But now I've realized it's not the work that matters most about school. It's spending time with other people and being interactive.
Well, I want to be in person, but how my school is doing it, where we're going to go to school and we're going to be Zooming in our costumes, that is, like, so stupid because I'd rather just do that from my house. It's, like, a waste of my time, and I don't want to go back for that. So I want to go back if it will be, like, not normal, but we can, like, be seeing our friends. But Zooming from school is, like, the stupidest thing ever, and I'd rather just not even go to school if it's like that.
Well, I don't really want to go back to school because I like doing school here on my computer because every time it's a daytime, I get to play with Bryce.
Oh, Bryce is your brother?
Mm-hmm.
So you like to do school at home because you can play with your brother?
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Well, what about your friends at school?
Well, I usually do like to the playground, so I'm gonna go back there once the virus is over.
Okay.
Sounds. But Miss Blue said that we can go to school, but with masks, and we need to use a special thermometer that checks if we're sick. And we need to do that every day we go to school until the virus is over.
My goodness. Hopefully it'll be over soon.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thanks for interviewing with me.
Hopefully it'll be over soon. Did you hear that? Yeah, fingers crossed. In order of appearance, that was Graham Lawson, Gray Witham, Bryce Lawson, Kate Raymond, Remy Mose, Skylar Baker, Brody Mose, Maxwell Dice, and Cole Witham, ages 4 to 13. Very articulate, by the way, 4 to 13-year-old. And thanks to each of the parents for taking time to play reporter and interviewer. And special thanks to Jenna Cagle for wrangling it all together and producing that piece for us. That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, taking a less than scrupulous shot at getting the shot, circumventing the system to get protected by the COVID vaccine. That's tomorrow's episode of GLA. By the way, if you are fully vaccinated, however you got the shot, how will your life change going forward? What do you plan on doing that you haven't been able to do for the past year? Oh, let the brain focus on that for a little while. And how did getting that shot make you feel? Share your stories of putting the pandemic behind you, and you could be on the radio talking about it, that first reunion with your family. KCRW.com, and subscribe to the podcast, too, while you're there. Catherine Barnes, Nihar Patel, Sonia Geis, Jenna Cagle, Kat Yore, Phil Richards, John Meek, Amy Ta, Mario Saavedra, Lorenzo Ponce de Leon, and Christian Bordahl all made the show happen this evening. Thank you for your ears and for your time tonight. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Have a great night.